Hey, doing, Gabriel?
Good. How are you?
Good. Every time I get reversed, Oh, I got two.
Hey, can I do a mark?
I did. Okay, because I really like that. Look at that.
Roll brim.
Yeah.
There's a few things set up here. I think you can sit up here. I guess I don't know.
It's all crash deal. Yeah, that'd be great. He's got it here too. Okay, we're going to call the meeting to order at 1802 hours. Conduct roll call. Gail Dick.
She's gonna be. But do we have anybody online, Kyle, that we can? Tim is here. No other members online?
No, Chuck on there earlier. Mark,
Charles, Mark Richards is here. Mark Opie is here. Jeff Lucas.
Here.
Gail Vick. Virgil Oppenhauer.
Here.
Mike Tinker. John Wisniewski.
Here.
Levi Llewellyn.
Here.
John Sifridge here. Austin Smith.
Here.
You're going to have to help me here, Warren.
Jukey.
Warren Jukey.
Third one.
It's hard. Bill Larry.
Kyle, did you call Bill?
Bill said he would be
after. Did you give Bill a call?
Yeah.
But did you call him and let him know about the meeting?
Okay.
Bill Larry. Mike Kramer.
Here.
Chuck Derrick.
Here.
Okay, one last time. Is Gail Vick here?
You heard Mike Pinker complaining on being here. We have no quorum.
So we have a quorum?
You guys didn't call me or
Gabriel Davis.
Lance can be in.
Gabriel didn't get, he's not on your new sheet. Gabriel Davis?
And Lance Knocker?
Yeah.
Is the alternate?
Yeah. Oh, there he is. Lance, good catch.
Introduction of our guests. We've got Andy Griska from Fish and Game. Deanna Jellin, Yukon River Summer Manager. Christy Gleason, Yukon River Fall Manager. Sam Decker from ADFG. Al Barrett, Board of Game. Chris Bai. Is Jim Simon? Is he on there?
No, I don't see Jim.
Rob Arnold.
Tim Hammond from BLM.
Tim Hammond from BLM. And is
who is ending in 171 that's calling in on the phone?
Yeah, hi, this is Chuck Brazil with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game with the Division of Commercial Fisheries.
What's your last name, Chuck? I didn't catch
it's Brazil, name. Like the country.
Okay, got it.
Gail's here.
Put on the record that Gail Vick is here.
And we also have Dave Valentine from the Troopers.
Yeah, have all those people.
Okay. Okay, go ahead and introduce yourself.
I'm Shane Ransbury, Commercial Fisheries. Mark Nelson, Fishing Game, Wildlife Conservation. Andy Griska, Fishing Game, Sport Fishing. Tony Hollis, Fishing Game, Wildlife. Lincoln Allen, Pine Glass, Wildlife Game. Clyde Burst, Alaska Wildlife Troopers Society.
And I got Christy.
Kyle Campbell, Port Portman. I'm Sam.
We got you.
Yeah.
We thought you'd have a beer.
so now we want to, yeah. Okay. I just quit. Was it Brian?
Brian.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, approval of the agenda.
Is everybody approved the agenda from our number 9th meeting? I mean, the minutes from the... I'm sorry, you're on the agenda.
Yeah, minutes. Yeah. Okay. All right. Minutes.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
That's the agenda.
Unanimous consent to approve the agenda.
That would be good.
Yeah, because I'm having to get in front of you.
Hello, Terry.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Thank you. Your comments first, John. Just if you have any comments, or someone put in the chairs.
So the first comment I need to make is that this is my first time as chairman for the board, so you're going to have to bear with me here. Mark is going to kind of guide me through this. You'll have to be patient with me. Other than that, we have a lot to do, a lot to cover this evening, and I would hope that people keep their comments brief so we can get through this in a timely manner. Subcommittee Chair, do you have anything, Dale? You did it all.
Nothing until we come down to the fishery.
Okay.
Same with Game Trap.
Yep. Okay, any concerns from or comments from the public? Any concerns or comments from the AC members? Okay. Approval of the November 9th minutes. Unanimous.
Unless anybody objects, we'll approve the minutes from November 9th. Right, unanimous consent.
Okay. And approval of the agenda. Unanimous consent. That's the same. We'll approve it.
If anybody wants to add anything to the agenda.
Does anybody like to add anything to the agenda?
I just have an announcement, right? Dr. Heimer's book just came out. I don't know how many people want it. It's kind of the history of Dollar Tree and management of Dollar Tree in Alaska. He's retired. I don't know. He's part of our Winston. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, his book just came out. And why, and how they come about with the full curl that was regulated.
Where'd you get it, Virgil?
Go to Coppola's on Wednesday.
I don't know where Alan
is. We'll go to Coppola's out, okay?
You want to know where it is? Why do you want to know? I bought it ready.
Oh, that's right.
Okay. What do we get it at, like,
You can just, you get it, go online to Wayne, or just, I'll tell you online. Really good book. Hey.
Mike Tinker's arrived at 18:10 hours.
Nice. We have our formal here.
And we have another guest. Can you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Dan. Come on.
Who?
We don't know who she is.
Hey, she opened the door for me. She's not all bad. These old guys like you at the door, Mark, and opens the door.
Yep. First thing on the agenda. Okay, so first thing on the agenda is Tim Hammond from BLM. He's going to talk about the Steve's Mountain Travel Management Program. Go ahead, Tim.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I apologize for not being able to be there in person. I caught a nasty bug, and I thought you all might appreciate me not sharing it with you, so this is the next best alternative. And in the interest of time, I thought, I understand you all have a map and have the maps there to refer to. I thought I would just talk through the maps quickly and then see where your questions head after that. I think that'll be the best way to get through the guts of this. But I'm happy to discuss anything you want, and I will also put my contact information in the chat here when I'm done, so you can get a hold of me later if someone wants to discuss it more in more detail. So if we start off with the White Mountains winter map, that's the says White Mountains approved travel management plan winter at the top, and it has the green outline of the White Mountains on there. Really, for both the White Mountains and the Skis, there's not a whole lot to say about winter. The entire area is essentially open to cross-country travel with snow machines up to 1,000 pounds and 50 inches wide. In research natural areas, there's no travel allowed over exposed soil or vegetation. And then in the White Mountains, there's about 220 miles of designated routes. Most of those are maintained in the winter, subject to having the resources to do that. There's 19 miles of non-motorized route along coming out of Wickersham Dome trailhead to accommodate people skiing up to Borealis Cabin, and then 12 miles of proposed additional motorized routes if we get the resources to construct and maintain it. Really, that's the gist of the winter travel for the White Mountains. Nothing really controversial or different than the past there. If you want to switch to the White Mountains summer map, it's a little bit more complex. The brown background area is no cross-country motorized travel allowed in the summer. The, I guess, sort of army green background area is open to cross-country travel with ATVs up to 1,000 pounds, 50 inches width. And essentially, that's no change from the previous management, though that's been the management for a long time. On the far side of Beaver Creek hasn't been open to OHP use, and the south side has been. There are some non-motorized areas down around, or I should not say non-motorized. There are areas that are limited to designated routes down around, coming out of Wickersham Dome, so you can see the trails are symbology used for the different types of uses allowed on them. There are 68 miles of summer motorized routes, 320 miles of non-motorized routes, and on 23 miles of that we're allowing e-bikes, which I'm not sure if y'all are familiar with. That's a bit controversial nationwide, and we are just kind of testing out the idea here with that 23 miles. There's 13 miles of proposed new motorized routes if we get the resources to build them, and 10 miles of proposed new non-motorized routes. If you note the on my map, they're bright pink. I don't know if they printed that way, but there are some bright pink or purple routes on there, one coming out of Wickersham Dome and one run up alongside the Mount Prindle Research Natural Area on the east side. Those are open to OHVs up to 1,500 pounds and 64-inch width, I believe. So we're looking at opportunities to accommodate the growth of side-by-sides out there. Based on our observations, we think the vast majority of current use is still four-wheelers, but side-by-sides are growing, and we're figuring out how to accommodate those as it grows. There's adaptive management built into this plan, which I'll talk about in a minute, to look at where can we increase vehicle widths and our weights and allow for more of that as we get trails maintained and upgraded. The next map, if you switch to the Gnome Creek map, and I apologize if it looks weird to me not looking at the camera. I'm looking at the maps on my other screen here, so looking a little bit above my camera. I think probably you're all familiar with Gnome Creek coming out of U.S. Road, two campgrounds in there, 19 miles of gravel road and old mine tailings. There's a wide diversity of uses in here, but it's also very intensively used. So the light tan area here is no cross-country OHV travel allowed in the summertime. Travel is limited to designated routes where they're present. The yellow area, which kind of looks like a strip through there with a blue spot in the middle, but the yellow area is open for street legal OHVs, 10,000 pounds or less, and anything smaller, non-street legal OHVs as well. And that was really to accommodate the, it's pretty popular to drive Jeeps in there and motorhomes and camp in there, and we didn't want to make travel and management decisions that stopped people from traveling in there on those tailings. The blue area in the middle there is just open to cross-country travel with whatever, so that's bigger motorhomes. There's some tailings in there that the Jeeps like to use and what have you. Let's see. And I should mention, too, the crosshatch area on all of these summer maps is an area where there's no use of domestic sheep, goats, llamas, and alpacas allowed. And that is fairly controversial, the llama piece. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it right now unless someone wants to dig into it. But if you are interested in that, I would encourage you to contact me and I can fill you in on where we are at that. There is a request that we amend our plan to change that decision, but I don't think we're likely to do that. And again, the bright pink or purple route up on the east side here is open to 1,500 pound, 60-inch OHPs or 64-inch OHPs. The brown routes are open to 1,000 pound and 50-inch wide OHPs. And I should say, too, that we changed, when we did our land use plan in 2016, we changed from using gross vehicle weight to curb weight. And that made it appear that we were reducing vehicle sizes, but we weren't. 1,500 pound curb weight, 1,500 pound gross vehicle weight and 1,000 pound curb weight are essentially the same vehicle. So that's confused a lot of people. Can explain that more if someone has questions about it. But the change to curb weight was to match the way the state measures or articulates vehicle weight in their generally allowable uses. So if you want to switch to the Spies Winter map, that's the two units on the map, both in kind of mint green color there. And really the story for the Spies is the same as the White Mountains in the wintertime. The whole unit is essentially, all lands are essentially open to cross-country travel by snow machines up to 1,000 pounds and 50 inches. There are 144 miles of designated motorized routes. Currently, those are not maintained in the wintertime because we just don't have the resources, but that could change in the future if we were to get those resources. And then there's 26 miles of non-motorized route, which is the Pinnell Mountain Trail. That's non-motorized year-round, but crossing it in the wintertime with snow machines is pretty feasible because the area around it is open to cross-country travel. And then there's 107 miles of proposed new motorized routes. That's the blue and bright blue and dark blue dotted lines on here. And again, that's if we get the resources to brush those out, clear them, maintain them to some degree. I don't know that we'd have to have a lot of additional resources to be able to maintain those in the winter the way we do the White Mountains trails. But it just takes work to you know, get them set and established initially. So, but that's proposed winter routes for the skis. And that's pretty much the story for the winter skis. And then if you want to switch to the summer skis map, this is where it gets more complex and probably where most of your questions will come in. If you look at the background colors first, the army green or OD green colors, there's a patch out near Chena Hot Springs Road, a patch down in the southeast corner of the southeast unit, and then a patch north of the Birch Creek Corridor on the east side, just below Circle Hot Springs. That background color there is open to summer cross-country travel with OHPs up to 1,000 pounds and 50 inch width. The light tan color, which is the north piece unit and sort of the western end of the south piece unit, summer OHP travel there is limited to designated routes. So cross-country travel is not allowed, and there's one sort of exception to that they'll talk about in a minute. And then the darker brown area, which is the southeast portion of the south unit and the Birch Creek Wild Scenic River Corridor, there is no summer OHP use allowed. So in the area where travel was limited to designated routes, there's brown routes and pink or purple routes on there, and then a black route. The brown routes are open to OHBs 1,000 pounds and 50-inch width. The purple or pink routes are open to OHBs up to 1,500 pounds and 64-inch width. The black routes are open to almost not, motorized travel, so you can drive highway vehicles on those black routes in there. And then the stippled area north of the Birch Creek corridor in the southeast unit, in that area, we're allowing for off-route game retrieval, even though there's no cross-country OHB use allowed. We're allowing for off-route game retrieval up to 1 mile off the route, and that can be done with up to three vehicles up to 1,000 pounds or one up to 1,500 pounds. So that was through some several meetings and working with Fish and Game. They provided some analysis to us, really showing that the highest caribou harvest area is in that region that's stippled, and then the state lands just north of there. And they were concerned about limiting OHB use would hinder their ability to manage the herd through harvest targets. So we did have some resource concerns in there, and we have requested $300,000 to do some trail work in there, because there are areas that really aren't quite suitable for the larger OHBs yet. But that was a decision to cooperate with Fish and Game, help accommodate their desire to meet harvest goals in there, and then get the funding request in to upgrade things to handle the use that we were allowing in there. You may also notice on the south border of the North Steese unit, there's some pink or purple routes there. Those are segments of trails on the ground that cross back and forth from state land to BLM managed land over and over and over. And we were calling those boundary routes. And because the state generally allowable uses allow for vehicles up to 1,500 pounds, provided they're not causing particular types of resource damage, it just didn't make any sense to set up a situation where someone could travel on the state land and not the BLM land riding down that trail. So that's the reason we allowed those to be up to 1,500 pounds. And the 1 mile game retrieval is allowed off of those routes as well. Let's see. And then there's a red down the southwest end. There's a red sort of dotted line there. That's a proposed route that we might put in if we get funding and resources to do that. The other thing important to mention here, and hopefully you can see it on your map, but there's a section of Preacher Creek. It's straight above the blue area marked Alaska State Land that's on the south side of the North Steese unit. And it kind of has a red, orange bound border on the brown map. That is intended to be allow for motorized travel through there, but because the currently used trail goes right up the creek, and that was identified in our land use plan as a riparian conservation area, and there was plenty of signs of damage going on, we deferred the motorized use there. It's open to non-motorized use now, and it's a high priority for us to get funding to locate a sustainable route out of the creek there and open it to motorized use to make that connection there. But initially, we're deferring motorized use on that route there. And then I guess the bright green lands that are outside the MCA, the travel management decisions there were made to match the state's general allowable uses, because those are not part of the conservation area or the Wild and Scenic River Corridor. So I know I ran through that really fast. I want to be respectful of your time here. I'm happy to answer questions as long as you want to ask them. Like I said, I will also provide my contact information if someone wants to discuss it in more detail. I'm perfectly happy to do that.
Does anybody have any questions?
Jim, Jeff Lucas, is there any, when you were talking about the trails and extending new trails, have you thought about using the public to help out on that any, like you did with the hiking trail?
Absolutely. Part of our outreach plan, we're planning to do a lot of public outreach to help people wrap their heads around this before next summer. And part of that outreach plan is going to be seeing where the interest is, who's got capacity and willing to work on it. There's some real challenges, I know, with people getting organized in a short summer and what have you. And there's people who want to help but just can't commit. But we want to find out where that interest is, and we're wide open to signing people up as volunteers. We would be interested if there are groups interested in forming a friends group. But that has some legal complications. There was a group that talked to us about that and decided they couldn't commit to the insurance. But absolutely, we're wide open to public help. And if you have time and want to help out there, call the office. We'll find a spot for you.
Thanks.
Yeah, Chair, Mr. Chairman, this is Chuck.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering if Mr. Hammett could talk a little about what are the repercussions of somebody that, goes outside of their boundaries with ATVs. What are the penalties?
Well, essentially it's a ticket, and to tell you the truth, I don't know how much the fine is. We don't have a lot of law enforcement rangers out there, and at least the first season, we're going to be asking them to try and take more of an educational approach than an enforcement approach. Obviously, they have to make a decision on the circumstances in front of them, but it is a ticketable offense to not follow the travel management plan. If there's severe resource damage caused by it, then we could also handle that as a trespass, but for a number of reasons, that's not our preferred option, and it's not a good deal for anyone to go that route. I really believe if we get good information out to people, the majority of people out there are going to try to follow the rules. We've seen a lot of people this year already communicating with each other about, hey, this is what I think the requirements are. So there's always going to be people who make honest mistakes and some people who don't care about following the rules. But I'm pretty optimistic that the users out here are going to work with us and try to do the right thing as long as we do the work to get them the right information.
Yeah, thank you for that.
I have a question. When I'm about to use something like this, I like to have one piece of paper in my hand. And I noticed on the state lands, like 12-mile summit, you didn't put in the connector trail over to Chino Hot Springs Road. I know it's mostly on state land, but it would seem to me that you'd put it in here just for all the, I mean, you've shown all the mining roads up in here, but then not shown that one. Was that a conscious decision or just leave it off?
I guess sort of was a conscious decision. We felt that the more routes we put on outside of where we were making travel management decisions, the more likely we were to put out confusing information. However, we are talking with the state about how we can cooperate and work together to get good information out, and having a jointly produced map that shows routes on both state and federal land and the allowable uses on them is certainly a goal for me. And I'm talking with DNR, I don't want to speak for them, but I think they are very interested in that concept as well.
I would just encourage you to do that so that it makes it a little easier on the user to have one piece of paper instead of having to take two or three with it.
And I appreciate that comment, and I tell you that just moved it up my priority list another notch. So.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I have Mark.
Yeah, Tim, Mark Richards, thank you for being here. I just have to say it is confusing. I think you realize that, and especially the thing with 1,000 and 1,500 pound vehicles, I think that's going to be problematic. I did want to ask you about, I don't want to go into the llama thing, but are horses allowed?
Yes.
And do you have any requirements as far as feed? As what feed can be brought in for horses?
Our land use plan requires that people using horses under a permit use weed-free straw and hay. I don't believe that's a requirement for what we call casual use if you aren't running tours or something, if you're out there with your own horses. But we certainly encourage weed-free if you can get it, because invasive species infestation off the road system where you can get to with horses are much more expensive to deal with and much more difficult to find and treat. So we encourage weed-free feed any chance you get.
Okay, as far as enforcement, you know, might not be present, what about signage? Are you going to, what kind of education efforts are you guys going to do to make, you know, everybody aware of these new regulations?
Yeah, we've got an $80,000 order in for signs right now, and I believe a couple hundred thousand dollars for seasonal labor to start getting those deployed next summer. We'll also be doing a effort to mark boundaries better so people can tell where they are relative to the state and federal lands and the Wild Scenic River Corridor. But signage is a big effort here. That $80,000 worth of signs is kind of the first shot. That once we get those out, we'll have an idea of, you know, where people are having difficulty understanding the rules and where do we need to boost additional signs. We're also interested in working with the state to explore the possibility, and I know there's we have to pay attention to state regulations, but if there is the possibility of putting joint signs up on state land or federal land with the same idea of showing them all on one map so people can see one sign and understand the requirements across the land, regardless of where they are. That's a conversation I'm interested in having with the state, and we have it on our list for outreach and education.
Yep. Just one more thing. That piece of state land that goes up to Preacher Creek that you said you're not going to allow motorized, a lot of people use that currently. So is that going to be a problem, you think? Because I know that stretch is heavily used, some state land, and they're on state land, and they're going to BLM land, and everybody wants to get to Preacher Creek there.
Right. I know there's current use out there. Like I said, there when we surveyed these, there was evidence of damage along the both the sides of the creek and the bars in the middle, continuing to erode and cutting out. It is a priority to identify a sustainable route through there. I suspect I'll be asking our law enforcement to really take an educational approach there, because there are people who use it, but we don't want to set people up to fail. We want to identify the issue and get it addressed as quickly as we can. So we'll certainly be informing people that we want them to defer motorized use there, but also requesting the funding to get in there and identify a route that will establish connectivity through there and prevent the problems that led us to defer it in the first place.
Thanks, Tim.
Al? Yeah, thank you. Al Barrett, three questions, I guess. One, can you give us an example of what is cold soils? How big of an area that has to be to qualify as cold soils? And then two, third is the southeast area that's close to all motor vehicles. It was quite a big area that had very little motorized use, you know, today? Why was urgent to close that area when there's no no issues with motorized vehicles in there right now?
Okay, I got two of your questions, so let me answer those. I think I may have missed the third. Exposed soils, you know, I'd say use your judgment. If you can see exposed soil or vegetation, don't run over it in the research natural areas. I think it's going to be unlikely that any law enforcement ranger is going to argue with you over a one-foot patch or something, but if you're marking up the soil in those research natural areas, that's a concern. Those are supposed to be preserving examples of unique ecosystems, and we just don't want cumulative inadvertent damage to them. You know, we have to pay attention to the hundreds and hundreds of people who go across there when each of those individuals only sees the damage from their one use. So sometimes it's hard to realize that you're contributing to that, but you know, the cumulative impact is what we have to manage for, and we really want to avoid damaging the soils in there. Like, if people are going to make honest mistakes too, if there's a small patch there and you hit it, sometimes that may be avoidable. But again, I think if people have the right information and they have an opportunity to avoid it, I'm optimistic that most people are going to. And then the closure on the southeast area, you know, really the rationale behind that was that there is virtually no use out there. We didn't find user-created routes out there. And in 2016, BLM nationally established a new travel management policy that discouraged opening areas to cross-country summer travel unless it's to meet a specific management goal. There was a lot of pushback from that within BLM from Alaska, but we do still have to pay attention to the policy. And with no user-created routes really out there to identify routes on, no way to really cross the Wild and Scenic River corridor where most of the access into the unit is, you know, it just didn't make sense to identify that as open to summer travel. If conditions change and there are people getting in there from the Chena Hot Springs side and there's more demand for it, we do have an adaptive management strategy to monitor use, talk to users, pay attention to changing conditions. And it is possible that down the road, portions of that could have designated routes established in it. But right now, there just weren't any routes to designate, so it didn't make sense to open it up.
Yeah, I'll just follow up on that last comment. Now it's currently closed, but you said if there starts to be activity in the future, which means people are breaking the regulation, then you would think about opening up the area. So are you encouraging people to try to get out?
No, not at all. It would take more than just people breaking regulations. If there were people talking to us, explaining that there is a demand to get out there and they have a way, there's winter routes they've identified that could be summer routes, we can look at things like that. But I'm absolutely not encouraging people to go out there and blaze summer trails. Yeah. And you said you had three questions. Did I get the third one? I think I missed it.
The southeast area,
people were motorized. Okay. Mr. Just one other thing, Tim, full disclosure. This area south of Birch Creek, south and east, you've taken off all the historic trails. You've taken them off of the USGS maps. I don't mean you, but the federal agents have. There are winter catch trails, all that kind of stuff from back in the mining days. Mail routes, winter freight routes, that kind of stuff, that are all out through there that have all been ignored in this planning process. I thought it was kind of interesting when you said if people start using it, because 50, 60 years ago, there were people out there all year round using it. And now what you're saying is, since nobody's out there this last 5 years. Levi hasn't got that far over yet. We're all going to have trails out in there. I just think it's kind of funny that, you follow that activity of taking the trails off the maps and then say, well, gee, there's no trails out in there. I guess we don't have to worry about them.
Yeah, that's a good point. We did fly these areas with helicopters and look for currently usable routes. That was the basis of our route inventory. And there's certainly routes on the historic maps out there, but there's really nothing on the ground that looks like it's been used recently. It's grown over. It's, just no indication of current use out there. In terms of historic trails, we did have discussions with DNR about RS-2477s, and they were, I think it's fair to say they were disappointed that we couldn't deal with those through the travel management plan. But basically, BLM has black and white policy that says those will not be considered in travel management planning. That doesn't mean DNR can't approach BLM and discuss them from another angle, but we don't have the option of dealing with RS-2477s through travel management planning.
Hey, Ben, this is John Siegfried. I got a question for you. How are you determining the weights on these OHVs? Is it going to be based on a company spec when you purchase it? Does it include all the aftermarket? Because, you can have a vehicle that weighs 1,000 pounds. When you buy it, you throw boxes on it, now it's over. And the
right.
Second question.
Sorry, go ahead.
What are there track restrictions? I mean, there's Argos with tracks out there, wheelers with tracks.
Yeah, but for your second question, track vehicles are not allowed right now. We're trying to get hold of funding to do some objective testing and look at the impacts of different types of vehicles, similar to what DNR has done on the North Slope. With the oil companies, but so far we haven't been able to secure the funding. And if we get good data, there's a possibility that other types of vehicles could be allowed in here. But right now there's a whole lot of opinions and very little objective data. There's some really biased studies out there that are published and presented as objective, but there's just not good data to work with. And it's easier to open up to additional uses as you find out that they're going to work than it is to allow them initially and then back down when you find out they're causing problems. So your first question about how we're measuring the weight, as I mentioned, we switched from gross vehicle weight, which is what you described of the vehicle plus passengers plus all the boxes and everything on it. We switched from that to curb weight, which is the manufacturer's published weight with a full gas tank and all the fluids in it. So curb weight is a number that you can look at a label on the machine and determine. That's how the state has always articulated the weight in their generally allowable uses, and it just made sense for us to use consistent terminology with them and have something where someone can look at the label on their machine and see does it meet the requirement or not. You're absolutely right. I can take a 1,000-pound ATV out there and load it up with another 500 pounds of gear and go out there, but that's not a change in the size of vehicles that we're accommodating out here, because when we were looking at gross vehicle weight, we had 1,500 pounds gross vehicle weight. Turn that into curb weight, you're looking at a 1,000-pound vehicle. So the size of vehicle that we're managing for hasn't really changed, except where we're allowing the larger side-by-sides, just the terminology for how we're articulating it. But that there should be a label on your machine that says this is the curb weight for this machine, and if there's not, you can look it up on the manufacturer's website, and it just is a more consistent way to look at it than trying to figure out how much weight you got piled on and what the gross vehicle weight is.
Any other questions?
Yeah, this is Chuck again. So does curb weight take into account of pulling you know, wheeled trailer behind with an ATV or whatever?
I don't believe it does. I'd have to look up the definitions, but I'm pretty certain the manufacturer's curb weight does not account for a towed vehicle, and that would roll into the gross vehicle weight, actually. So we're not going to be out there weighing your trailer if your machine fits the requirements. You know, the trailer is just like adding boxes on the machine.
Any other questions? Tim, thanks for coming in here this evening, and thank you. The board thanks you, and we appreciate you taking the time.
I appreciate the chance to talk with you. I will put my contact information in the chat here, and unless someone objects, I'm probably going to sign off because this bug really is not working well with me right now.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks. And moving on to Fish and Game and Trooper updates. Tony, are you in free?
Yeah, I got it. Mark and I finished our moose surveys with 20A. We decided this year we alternate between 20A and 20B, and last year was actually 20A, or 20B's term in survey. But, and we did 20A last fall, but we wanted to, because of the hard winter, compare last year to this year, so we did 20A again. So, we got the survey done late in November because of snow. We didn't have enough snow most of November, and it finally came right at the end, so we got a good survey done. We came up with an estimate of 11,048 moose and 20A. That's down from last year's estimate, was 14,000. So it's about 3,000 less moose on the point estimate. Our objectives in that area are 10,000 to 15,000, so we're still within our objectives. The bull cow ratio for this survey was 28 bulls per 100 cows, which is down a little bit from 35 per 100 last year. And then the cow to cow ratio was actually pretty high this year. It was 83 per 100.
Question.
We still don't have all the harvest data in for this season and all season stuff, but it's starting to get in our database. So far, for 28, we're up over 400 moose harvested in 28, so we're going to be on track to get about normal for moose harvest.
Mike?
Funny, the lateness of the survey, does that compare with the year before, too? Or
we've been getting a lot of late surveys done.
That was, I mean, do you feel they're comparable?
I think they're comparable. We started a little earlier last year, but it took longer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, your moose are moving a little bit.
Yeah.
So a small difference could be accounted by having to move around.
I think, you know, although down by, point estimate shows down by 3,000. That may or may not be exactly confidence intervals, but it's still in the ballpark that we want to be in. But it's not necessarily, we always want more moose, but we're not in a big panic. I think that's pretty good after a hard winter. Mm-hmm. So,
Virgil?
And you said there were 32 calves for 100 cows?
33.
Okay, what about the yearlings?
I haven't calculated the yearlings yet, but they'll be down because we lost more cattle.
Tony, how's it looking with the snow already and everything happening? It's looking like it'll be snow winter.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, we got snow. We started on November 2 right after the day after Thanksgiving, or 2 days after Thanksgiving, our survey. Anyway, we got all the, we always do the foothills and the mountains first, as soon as we can, because the weather's a little bit of crap down there. We had great conditions in the mountains and the foothills the first couple days. We got all our sample units done down there, and it was a good thing, because that, the snow, more snow came in, and bigger Chinook winds down there, and blew, there is no snow down. It is like down to brown ground. So we're glad we got that done, and then when we finished up the last portion.
So what if we get below the IM objective? What if we get down to 10,000? I mean, we're
thinking about that.
Yeah. Okay.
So in the past, the ratio of year to year for 28, has that been, this 20B basically seemed the same?
It's very similar in general. Yeah, they track pretty closely. Now it's out.
Any other questions?
You don't have a 20B survey for us?
No.
We really only have time to do one survey unless we happen to get enough snow at the beginning of our event. We have to get them surveyed before the antlers, majority of the antlers come off the poles. So even that survey, you start seeing one antler pull, but and we get it shed out.
We started on the 28th November, went to 9 straight days, we were able to fly 8 of them. We screwed together every airplane we could get, and we had 2 and 5 going every day, so that's a pretty big effort to do. Yeah.
Good job.
Actually got it done on a fast day.
Yeah, good job.
Yeah. That it? Valentine.
I don't really have a lot. At the end of the 40-mile herd, the hunt's been a close 1-4. It was a pretty slow end of the season. We didn't have a lot of citations. We're continually looking for control up there just to make sure nobody else is up there. There has been a little bit of an increased harvest over and we've seen over in, off the Taylor Highway. I can give some info about Sheldon Bushy to Mark. He just got it. And I think you want to talk about it maybe at the next meeting. So
yeah.
I was kind of thinking you were going to talk about it now, but I guess we'll talk about it next time. So, that it?
Any questions?
Thanks, Danny. Oh, Danny, what, do you guys do anything like, do you have problems like with the subsistence hunters? Like, do you think that they're non-federally qualified? Like, do you have any instances like that where you see somebody, but it's a federal hunter?
Yeah, you know, the most, the only times you run into these issues is out on the Taylor Highway and they're shooting on the state lands. They're usually qualified, but they just don't know where they're hunting. And they're
yeah. Mm-hmm. And what do you guys do when that happens?
Usually they get a ticket and they play it.
But do you confiscate the meat or?
Yeah.
Or you do? Oh, okay. Thanks.
Okay, this time we're
going to... Sorry. This is Brian Durst. He's one of our new wildlife troopers here. This is his first meeting, so we're just kind of getting pulled up in the area.
But that's why we're being so nice tonight.
Yeah, Doug.
Okay, moving on, we're going to go to the Fishery Subcommittee recommendations for the Board of Fish on the AYK proposals. And, Gail, I'm going to turn this over to you.
So, does everybody have a copy of the worksheet on this? Before we do the proposals, we did not approve the minutes from the November meeting, so I'd like to get that update. The only questions I had, I couldn't show exactly who all was there. Jeff, were you at that November 17th?
Oh. No.
Okay.
I tried to call in and I was having trouble.
So okay. I couldn't tell exactly who was on it. And then Levi?
He just stepped out.
Yeah, he just stepped out, right?
He might, no.
Austin?
I was not.
You were not, yeah. And Warren? And Bill, Larry was not.
Bill, can I just say something? So the subcommittee meetings were not required to be there. It's just voluntary. Whoever wants to be there.
Correct.
We don't call the roll at subcommittee meetings.
No, but for the minutes, I just wanted to.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, we're good. That was all I had. Thank you. So if the subcommittee members are willing to approve it tonight, I'd like to give this business approved so we can come on the record. Any objection? Okay. All right. So if you will go to that spreadsheet, I'll try to go through these very quickly. Is my speaker on?
Right here. It's me at the end of the day.
Can I
Kramer. He's here.
Yeah, he's here.
He was.
He left.
So on proposal 63, we're going to support that with comments. Those comments will be on the spreadsheet. Proposal 64, do not support. We should see a man vote for enforcement. 65 is take no action. It's a litigation until family staffs are rebuilt. 66, Harding Lake is one of the AC proposals. We are supporting that. And stop me, anybody, if you have any questions since we're doing this. 67 is do not support. 68, we took no action on that. That's a key lake. It's a remote lake up in the Upper Canada, but I was on the Upper Canada AC meeting last night, and I got more explanation than I did get. Confirmation from ADF&G and Bell Deduction that says there is no abundance problem with that lake. So I'm just suggesting that we be supported.
That's the Burbitt one?
With, correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I suggest we support that. And then number 69, do not support. The comment was that we can, I think Virgil did that. We should solve that problem by putting up signs and using only single hooks. So we're going to make that comment. And these comments that we have on here, we're going to the Board of Fish with our comments for the public person. Number 70, which is that goodness on the Chena. We did support with comments. And the comments there that Mike Tinker contributed was the limiting date from June 1 through March 31 outside the spring migration period and remove the exposure of concentrated fishing immediately after ice helps. Only single hooks are allowed in this fishery. So that was their comment. Number 71, we have that as one of ours as well, and we support that. Number 72, we support that one. With a note that in future AC meetings, we'd like to get a stocking report. Because we just have questions.
Do you think there's still federal movement of it?
I'm sorry.
Do you think there's still federal of it when you do the numbers? And some of them are some of them.
Yeah.
Sure. I don't, I think kind of got it. It's like, right, right. Yeah.
So, 72 is a basic beauty proud in those. Not stalking, not catching.
Yeah. So the issue there was we found out what's being stopped and what is it. But it's too fast. It's too fast. Right. Number 73, which is Baglin's also for the Panama River. We support that and reflecting the language in number 72. If anybody who the actual proposal, I have more books. 74 is a Canada River Stock Waters Plan. This is the department proposal, and we are supporting that. 75 is a bag limit in Northwestern, and we're taking no action because that's a Norton Sound Reserve issue that we do not feel comfortable on this one. 76 is a gillnet spec and operations issue submitted by Jeff Antner from a lot of the snow from the Cotterview area, and we do support that. 77 is the DHL for Port Clarence out of the Nome area. This is the proposal submitted by Charlie Moon, and you know him, and we reviewed them.
Jeff, can we back up to 76 just for a second?
Sure.
76 is one that's got some language in that's caused protection to have some problems with. It's got language like reasonable distance that's not defined. And in the conversation, we're going to probably, not so much in our comment here, but in others, ask the board to talk about that so that you guys have some guidance for what's a reasonable distance. I mean, for example, in ice fishing, sometimes that's where you can see the tip up. You know,
that kind of thing.
Eight from the cabin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But apparently up here this has caused some problems because but it's breaking with what the traditional use is there, and that's causing the locals some heartache.
You know, it came out of the new enforcement in the area.
So for those that don't know what that is, that had to be a requirement that if you have a set net up there, that you had to be there and manning the set net at all times. You could not leave. Go take a coffee break, go somewhere else, and so that's what that issue is about.
And it's not done like that other place.
Yeah.
Maybe some places might.
But it's not been done like that before there either.
On the sentiment issues, it all depends on where you are, and if you really have to keep control of your gear all the time, that's the purpose for doing that. But you can obviously do that in this situation. Any other questions on 70? That one?
No, go ahead.
So, we're not on 78, which is fishing carries out of Kotzebue. We're going to take no action. 79, which is on the Koyukuk on Lawful Jurisdiction, and that was submitted by the Koyukuk agency, and we are supporting that. Number 80 is the Chinook, submitted by Del Lamont for the CWU, and we do not support that. Number 81, the city. So this was one that we submitted. And this is basically designed to allow during period of conservation mode, not in a regular season, but in a conservation mode season, that on a subsistence permit, you can take, using DNF command fishbill permits, you can take, some Chinook that are so sizing on. This is basically a tool to allow people to, get Chinook, during this time when, you really want to get bigger Chinook up the river. Just that.
And the permits for the upper part are for schools and DNFs?
Yes.
So
what Dale's talking about is having a permit for the entire Yukon River operation. That would be different than our normal permits that we have on the road system. This is an addition. This is a new deal.
And the other thing we should do is, there are some differences between us just saying a 24-inch salmon and the way they're normally described for length, the way the department does it, for example. And if we continue on with this, or when we continue on with this, we need to wrap those use the same definition so that no one is confused about what we're measuring there. I think there's a couple little things like that we can do when it's appropriate to get this. Now, we have another problem with this one at the moment in that the various organizations that have banded together and talked about the low salmon returns for the Yukon have adopted the slogan of every fish counts. And we have a bit of a problem with it in terms of pushing it right at the moment because it is contradictory to that. A permit for this would not be a recognition that every fish we need to get to the spawning grounds. So this is going to be... Gail, I'm sure we'll talk about our options here, but we may want to hold this.
Well, there's another option that came up since I mentioned.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, I mean, that's good. The other thing we talked about was that this would be a tool in the toolbox, and if we don't put it in there, then it doesn't become available to the department. For example, if we get a minimal fishery, but not much of it. So.
And I'd like to give a little background because I just talked with Eagle, and we had a group meeting this morning for River Hawaii. They were concerned for that very reason Mike just mentioned about the nest line. Every fish does count right now, but we're in a place right now we can't fish at all. So this proposal is for when we have a harvestable surplus around 4,000 fish or so that we can
utilized, and it also has helped equalize the opportunity down the river, which is so. In the meantime, that I was assigned this morning and throughout the day to the job disposal, but I subsequently talked with these people. Holly Carroll, are you there?
Yes, she has a question.
Yeah, and Holly, just if you could hold for a minute, because yeah, Holly, you join us. But also, I talked to Dr. Curry Cunningham just a little while ago, and I, if you don't know Curry, does a lot of genetic work on salmon trout, and extremely knowledgeable on the species subcommittee for them. Anyway, he thought it was a good idea to keep in the toolbox. He said, obviously not for now, but for any time in the future, we have surplus. And this is Chinookoma, so just keep that in mind. So, Holly,
did
you want to make
a few
comments?
Yeah, that'd be great. Can you guys hear me okay?
I hear you, thank you.
Yeah, I'm having a little bit of hard time hearing you, Gail, but I got the gist of it. I can understand your guys' reservations, but I've got to agree with Curry Cunningham and you know, for those of you who don't know me, I have been involved in management on the Yukon for 8 seasons. I was the manager for the state of Alaska, and now I'm the federal in-season manager. And one of the things that I saw when I read this proposal, that this was truly thinking outside the box. And what we've had over the last, you know, just 8 years that I've been involved in management is we've had run sizes varying from a harvestable surplus of 2,000 or 3,000 fish to zero, to 50,000, right? These runs are kind of all over the place. And sure, while we're in a terrible situation right now where fisheries need to be completely closed, you know, passing this proposal wouldn't make it so that people would be fishing when they can't be fishing. I mean, that's not how I interpret it. But I do interpret it as one of the only tools that we have not had, which would allow us to very surgically provide harvest opportunity when we have these very small harvestable surpluses of 3,000 to 5,000 fish, for instance. And, you know, we don't have forecasts saying that that won't occur in the next 3 or 4 years. So for me, I got really excited when I saw this proposal. Now, my preference, and our service comments aren't finalized yet, but my preference would be to support it with the modification that the size of fish and the bag limit be determined by emergency order. Because, you know, I think the size of fish changes over time. Fishing game, test fisheries, long-term data sets give us a really good idea how many 4-year-olds we might be seeing, what size they should be. Same as bag limit, you know, 10 fish per family would be a very large harvest. So, of course, right now we're not in an era where we would use that. But let's say that there's 2,500 fishing households. If we had a 5,000 fish harvestable surplus, that's only 2 fish per fishing household. Our current management tools don't really allow us to equitably offer that kind of precise opportunity and hope to hit that target. And this proposal kind of thinks of everything. First, it requires that permit. Comfish Division has an excellent record of running a harvest permit program that has really good reporting, so we could keep track of that harvest. And then 2, by allowing that retention in the selective gears, it makes the opportunity very surgical. So, like, when we let people go out with gill nets, it's like giving them a fire hose, right? We have a hard time limiting the harvest in that. So, by allowing it from selective gear or fish meal, for one, those are gears that are available to nearly every household, and so that's equitable. And then the other thing is it allows for the fishermen to control that harvest. So, let's say we set a bag limit of 2 or 3 per year, that could actually be achieved. So when I saw the proposal, I was really excited that someone was thinking outside the box, and I've unfortunately not been able to kind of engage with enough stakeholders, because the meetings have kind of been all over the place, to let them know that, that's how I feel as a manager, that this is a tool we haven't had. For multiple years, I've been saying that now that these runs are at this low level where in some years we can meet goals and then still have a tiny harvestable surplus, we have a really hard time getting that harvestable surplus equitably across the whole drainage. So this permit system that this proposal proposes would be an excellent way to do that. So I get your concerns about the fact that we shouldn't, you know, we might not be fishing now. I don't see that negates the importance of this in the toolbox. If in 2 or 3 years' time these runs come back to 60, 70,000 fish, we would be able to, 60 to 70,000 Canadian origin, let's say they're up in the 180s, we'd be fishing again, but we'd be fishing a very small amount. And so this type of tool is missing from our toolbox. So, yeah, I just wanted to put that out there. That's kind of where I'm at with it, and I'm certainly happy to answer questions you might have or discuss any of the other proposals.
Thanks, Holly. Questions, Holly?
Mike.
Kramer?
Yeah, thanks. We've talked about this proposal many times over the past year, and I just haven't been in favor of it. I haven't opposed it. I wanted to learn more. You know, we talked about it at the subcommittee meeting, and some other folks present made some good points. And we asked questions about the spawning viability of 24-inch, you know, king salmon. And I think it was generally agreed that a 24-incher is going to be a successful spawner, and there's very little evidence that they're just going to beget other 24-inchers, and that we need every fish on the spawning grounds possible, whether it's 24 inches or 36 inches. I think the biggest problem with this is, say we have a harvestable surplus of 3,000 fish, and we cut 2,500 fishers loose with fish wheels and dip nets, and say they can harvest, you know, X number of 24-inch fish. It's going to be an enforcement nightmare. No one's going to be out on the Yukon River, seeing what fish go into people's fish holes. It's going to be really hard for a family that, you know, has not been able to keep a king for years, you know, to dip net a king or watch one flop in the wheel, you know, that's 27, 28, even 38 inches, and throw it back in the river. Once that thing's filleted, it's going to be virtually impossible to ever make an enforcement case. And there's going to be catch and release problems. Fish wheels are not maintained closely, you know, despite best intentions. Dip nets, you know, fish get tangled up. They got to be drug into the boat. The measuring case got to be procured. The thing has to be measured, you know, maybe measured twice because they're flopping around. And is it from the eye to the fork of the tail, or is it to the tip of nose, the tip of tail? No one really knows. And then ultimately if it's 27 inches, okay, let's flop it back in the river. Well, then you probably got a dead fish. I just think the negatives outweigh the positives of allowing just a little bit of harvest. If we have a 3,000 fish harvestable surplus, let everybody fish and keep one king or two kings, whatever we can afford, any size, and then stop fishing. I think that'd be my preference.
Good point, Mike. But I have a question. Chrissy? Some of the discussion on this was that it would help equalize the fishing opportunity up and down the river when you were trying to make determination of how many fish can be fished in a low surplus time. So what would you be would be your interpretation?
So I would turn that question over to Dina, because for this proposal, she is the summer season.
Okay. Oh, sorry, Dina. I didn't know you were online.
Thank you, sir. Good. But okay. I have my right book.
Yeah, I can hear you guys. Yeah, sorry, I didn't come in. I'm feeling a little bit under the weather, so I didn't come in to be in person and cough all over everybody. But yeah, I did hear the question. It's hard to say that everybody on the Yukon has an equal chance, just the way that fish are distributed. You're always going to see more fish in the lower Yukon, and then as they peel off and go to spawning, you're going to have fewer fish as they go upstream. So I don't know if that helps to answer your question. This permit could be a way to give, you know, every household or any household that applies for it maybe an opportunity to get, you know, a limited number of fish. You know, everybody may get the opportunity, but everybody may not have an equal chance of encountering that salmon, depending on where you live.
Yeah, so is there any estimation with the size of the runs we have, how many fish in those runs are even in the size range? Like, how many fish are even going to
be? About 20%.
20%. So it's a significant amount.
Yes.
And then also, will the size of the run determine the size, or is it 24 inches decided?
That's why she's suggesting, Holly's suggesting, go to a set of size by NEL, which is a great idea.
So essentially, this is a tool to limit the size of the fish, just depending upon how big the run is.
So the test the size of the run by using a variable mesh net down at the very lower pilot station area. So early in the run, they have a fair idea of what percentage are various sizes. And obviously, they're going to keep going up the river like that. That doesn't change. So if they saw a particular size in there where you could make this determination and kick those off. So my question would be, if I could, Gail, the Canadians are pretty convinced throughout their entire Chinook area, British Columbia and Yukon, that these small kings are not viable spawners.
Curry disagrees with that.
Well, that's fine, but you know, they're on record as saying that they don't. And so the question, so the question would be, what is our policy on that? Have we done any work on that, or are we just?
I'll try to answer that just briefly. So our escapement goals are based on total number of fish. And so a lot of times these fish that are coming back small, they're often males that are coming back young. So if that male did, you know, for whatever reason, decide to stay in the ocean and continue to eat and continue to grow, it might come back as a bigger, older male. Usually these fish that are coming back are just coming back young and small because they've decided they're going to get out of the ocean and they're going to go for it. Yeah, that's kind of just what they're doing. And it's an interesting evolutionary strategy because that kind of hedges your bets. You've got all these fish that hatch in a single year. They go out to the ocean. Some of them are come back as 4. Some are going to come back as 5. Some of them are going to come back as 6 and 7. It's kind of a way to spread out, you know, the fish from that brood year across multiple years of returns.
The question I think Mike is trying to get to, yes, is that the speculation is that the more jacks we have on the spawning ground, the more we're going to lower those genetics. And we don't have studies to say yay or nay on that right now. So there's a number of lab studies that show what that's not. And there aren't any studies in a natural setting on the Yukon. Right. So the laboratory studies have all shown that the jack salmon beget big salmon.
Well, they, yeah.
So what about the female? What about the female? I mean, obviously there's not a ton of reproduction there. What about the females?
Well, this year we did document 4 gills. We started sampling all of the jacks that we found.
Yeah.
Just to confirm that they were down at the Monarch Gill Station.
Yeah.
But is it preponderance males?
Of the jacks?
Yeah.
But there are people down the lower river who suggested this morning that they've been getting some female jacks and they were loaded with eggs.
Yep.
Generally speaking, we know that the bigger the female, the bigger the egg, and maybe the better.
More of them.
Better propensity, but better.
Okay, my turn.
Okay.
I somehow resist having fish people here give their update. That would have helped a little bit. Maybe, and maybe not. But I've been involved in this issue right here for right at 30 years. We have some of the world's leading scientists. And we just come back from this meeting here. A couple of us in the room were at this meeting, the Treaty of Canada meeting. And their head guy, head of delegation for Canada.
Oh, God, Mark.
He's also the head of British Columbia, all of the old treaty, the transboundary rivers. And so I asked him a simple question. Because we talked about this issue. Some of the Canadians are interested in this issue. And some of their First Nations people, which is basically their tribes, are called, they call themselves First Nations rather than a tribe. And they're interested in maintaining their historical and traditional methods of teaching the young people how to deal with fish. But they're being just like we are, but way worse. Like up at Teslin, yeah, I don't think they've fished for 20 years. Maybe more. But they've been screaming about the fish being smaller and not as many fish for a long time. But anyway, so they're interested now. So I asked Steve, the head of the Canadian delegation, and he lives in Whitehorse. But I asked him about this issue because in the southeast, for its statement, fish has to be 655 millimeters. And when I calculated it, or divided it, 2.54 or 25.4 into 655, I get 25.76. But when we had our meeting on the fish subcommittee meeting, it was said it was 25.8, but 3/100 of an inch. Anyway, when you measure the fish, you've got a stick, and you're going to try to make it that long, you're going to play hell knowing the difference between 25.76 and 25.8. Anyway, I don't want to waste a whole bunch of time. This thing has been debated at the Board of Fishery Arena, and at times it's passed. There's, on the Kenai River you can do it. I believe the Copper River, under a certain size, you're allowed so many that don't count in the regular limit. Now these fish, Larry Engel, I was on the board with a guy named Larry Engel that was a retired pork fish biologist, and he was in on a study, University of Washington, where they took large females and fertilized their eggs for jacks, and 75 to 87 fish came back from that were jacks. And so that has been done scientifically by the University of Washington. And I think Larry's still alive, although he's getting up there in age, just like I am. But this issue has been up and down over the place. But the thing about this is we have very competent managers. The managing fisheries, one of them sitting right back there. And there's no way in hell we're going to open up a fishery when the situation is like it is now. That's why we should have a little bit of a brief from them, but I'll just very briefly do it. 30 seconds, I can do it. This is the local work around the Philip Dam since they've been in the continent. It's the third worst run of fall trout salmon, and I'm not sure what worst it is. Second worst for summer trout salmon, maybe. Can't be wrong on that one. I'm pretty darn close, though.
Of course.
No way I'm going to let anyone fish on purpose to kill salmon right now. My time's up.
Good.
No, I'm good.
Chuck?
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, my question kind of falls with Mike Kramer's there. I'd like to ask Holly, are the fish wheels up there, are they required to have a live box, or have they ever been required to closely attend?
I can answer that. So right now we have regulations in place that can require the release of manned fish wheels, and that what that means is that the fish can't enter a live box. You've got to have somebody standing there with a chute or a tote or some methods to immediately take the fish from the basket and put it right back into the river. You have to immediately release it alive. That's the current reg that we have for in times of conservation.
Okay.
I guess I'd like to follow up on that if I could, unless you had another one, Chuck. So, because, you know, Mike raises a good point about the handling of the fish. They got to handle it to measure that 25 inches. And that's why, quite honestly, I never loved the 24-inch thing. I can see the value in it. But for me, I loved the bare bones of the proposal, which is use selective gear, which we're already doing. It's manned and allow some harvest determined by the managers. And then you're not going to get that same handling stress as if you're measuring the fish. I also take Kramer's points about, you know, sure, every fisherman that's going to encounter a larger fish is going to have that crisis of, conscience, like, should I let it go, should I not? We worry about that all the time, and that's why I would say leave the bag limit, leave the size to the managers. But I think at some point we do have to trust fishermen who maybe haven't fished in years. They get their permit. We set a bag limit. Let's say it's 2 per person. I think there's a lot of people that would go out there and do the right thing, take their 2 fish, be proud to share that with their elders, and move on. I think, it's no different than trusting people to go out with dip nets like we have for the last 6 years, or it's no different than trusting people to go out with their 4-inch and hope they're really targeting non-salmon. So, I guess I share Mike Kramer's concerns, but again, what I see about this proposal is it is a tool that allows managers the opportunity to set a bag limit for subsistence. That is not something we've done on the Yukon. That's the part that's super novel. And as a manager, like Virgil's saying, it ain't going to happen this year, probably. You know, I think we're not going to have a run where this is an issue. But once that fishery run comes back and we need to go after a few fish, this could be an incredibly effective tool at very efficiently hitting that harvest target. So I get your concern, but if we wait for 3 or 4 years to put a proposal like that in, we could see fishable runs in that time. I'd love to be hopeful and say that's what's going to happen, and I'd love to have that tool in the toolbox when it does happen. If not, maybe we can try to do this proposal again as it should be, because right now it does need, in my mind, it needs some modifications. It sounds like even you guys agree it needs some modifications, but I'm excited to have the public discussing it because it is such a unique tool that we currently do not have. Currently, we do not have the ability, even when we allow those manned wheels, we allow the dip nets. We don't have the ability when we have a quote unquote conservation concern for Chinook. We don't have the ability to let them have 1 or 2. It's all or nothing. We're either in selective gear and you can only keep chum in that and release the king. But we don't have that ability to make them use that selective gear and just keep a couple. So that's the novel portion of it. Whether you think it's worth continuing with this proposal or not, you know, fair enough. That's for you guys to decide, but it definitely got my wheels turning, and I'd sure like to see it discussed at the board because it is truly thinking outside the box for when we do need to go after these tiny surpluses.
Could I follow up on that? This is Chuck again, then. So just to clarify, I sort of heard that Fish and Game has the power to, require closely attended, or is that in regulation now that they have to closely attend? And if this proposal does go through, I would like to see something in there about closely attended fish wheels, because without closely attended and without a live box and that, you're going to get kings put into that fish wheel that are going to sit there that are way above that 24-inch. And you're going to have mortality when you're trying to get every king you can up that river.
Yeah, perhaps Dina can better articulate it, but yes, when we are in quote-unquote selective gear mode, it's manned only for fish wheels. We either don't allow them or we make them be manned. And I see this proposal, assuming even as it's written that the managers would have the ability to say, we are not allowing retention from selective gears unless there is a harvestable surplus. And when it's selective gears, so the dip net and the fish wheel, then it would have to be manned. And so, again, that may be a conversation where, depending on how this goes at the Board of Fish, you know, you might suggest that that change to the language, that it would be from manned fish wheels and dip nets, because that's how we operate the wheels when we are in conservation mode. They must be manned.
Yeah, and this is Dina's fishing gate. That'd be something that we would maybe kind of ask law, because in our current regulation now, during times of conservation for kings, we can, by emergency order, require that fish wheels are closely attended and kings are released immediately. So then we would perhaps need to write an EO that says, like, it's a time of conservation, you can have a fish wheel, you have to release kings immediately unless you have this permit, in which case you can keep, you know, whatever limit is on the permit. So that would be kind of that'd be something that we would talk to law and figure out how we would have to write our EO to reflect that, if that's what we ended up going with.
Okay, this is Chuck. Thank you very much.
Mike Kramer.
Thanks. I'm a comment, and I'll try to be brief. I'm all for having tools in the toolbox, particularly those that allow harvest. And I like that idea of looking at it. I've always been a pro-harvest whenever an excess or a harvestable surplus is available. In this situation, and I'm all for the Board of Fish having a serious discussion about this and similar proposals, and I'm sure there's going to be amendments made. And if anything passes out of this, it's probably going to be quite a bit changed from what we're looking at today. I still don't know where I sit. I've got more information, you know, tonight on it, and I appreciate the managers putting their take on it and their enthusiasm for it. As far as whether someone's going to go through the effort of launching a fish wheel and manning it in days of returns like this, I mean, they could be sitting next to that wheel for hours between fish, and then they get a 20. Anyway, I think it's just unrealistic that people are going to actually, you know, deploy fish wheels to catch 2 24-inch fish. We've talked about the Gulcan. I'm looking at the regs now. A jack there is defined as 20 inches. Or less than 20 inches. And I fish the Gulcan a lot. And when you catch one of those rare 18, 19 inch kings, you know, you can just, they're not viable spawners. And I think there's a big difference between a less than 20 inch king and what essentially is a 26 inch king when you measure it from tip of tail to tip of nose. Or I'm sorry, the tip of the nose to the tip of the tail. I just think there's a big difference. And, you know, in other places where we recognize the harvest of jacks is separate from the big kings, we call them 20 inches, not 26.
That's a good point, Mike. As far as fish wheels go, wheels are not going to be in the water unless there's a harvestable chunk.
Unless they're going to be fishing chunks, that's right.
I mean, nobody's putting their wheels in the water fishing stuff. So in this case, the real viable tool would be a dip net. If people are fishing chub, if there's harvestable surplus, then this rule would apply on a permit that they could keep a king under a certain size. But I have a compromise here. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, the issue facing us isn't to work out every single detail. It's whether we're going to take it forward or withdraw it. And I think what we're hearing is that the discussion needs to be had. And the discussion can't be had by the board unless we move it forward. So if we just agree on that, we just leave our proposal there, we can enhance our comments to these. I love the idea of using an EO size after you look at what you got out there and see where that should break. And whatnot. And I think Mike's not quite right on the Gulcan. I think what it says is it doesn't define a jack. It says a king salmon less than 20 inches, you can have 10. It doesn't say that's a jack salmon or not. Most jacks are, you know, under 8-10 pounds. So it's a little bit different, but I think we should move our proposal forward, perhaps with some of these, comments about how we're going to get there, not say it's 20 inches or 50 inches, but how your manager can decide that.
But if you guys like the idea that how it being presented, I mean, you guys can even support your proposal with an amendment to the specific MSI by EO.
Right.
And then I looked at your guys' proposal, and I think
it already says that you would have to man your wheel closely the way you wrote it.
Right.
And it's already, you wrote it under a new section, and so I think it would probably be okay where it's already assuming that you're going to allow retention of the king instead of retaining 10 feet. So it's in a different section of our conversation than where we take a manuscript bill at a little small.
Yeah, we've got
it.
My suggestion, just a minute, Virgil. My suggestion would be that we go forward with very detailed commentary from the board. And with all these comments that we've heard, I'd love to incorporate comments that I heard from people on the river as well, because these are serious concerns. So that we can encourage that discussion. Virgil, you have a question?
Right. It's not a question. I just something I want to point out that a lot of people in the room aren't really aware of on poverty. And that is that we started having these king salmon really bad runs 2008 after we go to the last year of commercial fishery for king salmon in the Yukon. And I don't know, was it 12 or 13? Really bad? I think that's what it was. As soon as the book I got here. But anyway, so what happened is a proposal got put in to fish for chum salmon with dip nets in the lower Yukon. The board passed. I supported that when they put it in. But I may have been the chair of AC when that happened. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was. Anyway, we supported that. And they had to release these alive. That was so they could fish, because otherwise they were going to be totally closed. They had to fish with the gill net until all the kings were gone, which means they would not have a summer shrimp commercial fishery. And so the board passed that. And then as soon as the board passed that, I put in a petition to do the same thing, only have manned fish wheels, fish-friendly fish wheels. And there's a definition of that anyway, right? Fish-friendly?
It's in this commercial reg.
Yes.
It's not in the business requirement, right?
Okay, well, it could be put right in the statistics regs as well. It's in the commercial regs. It specifically defines a fish-friendly fish wheel, which means no wire net and no wire mesh in the basket. It has to be webbed. So they use seine web is what they use. Foam padded shoots. You have to have a device that you can stick across the box when a king salmon gets in the wheel. And what most people use is a kid's plastic toboggan. They slide that over. It slides out of the chute on the basket into that thing, over the top, and right into the river. And people fish commercially like that out of Caltag, fish like that out of Nenana. And so it's been done, and there's no reason why it can't be done for subsistence feeder. And so it needs to go forward, and we have to explain it a little bit. The board needs, because the board has addressed this before, but those board members, only maybe one of them still on the board.
And I think they talked, I remember years ago at a board fish meeting, they talked about making the system field match the commercial rig where they're fish friendly. But I think the board at that time said that that would require a pretty big modification to everyone's wheel up on up the down the Yukon for subsistence. Versus they were okay with it for commercial because it's a smaller group of people and could have the financial assistance to
right.
But I so already anticipate that that's probably going to come up is the board's going to look at the cost of modifying here, even though it's you know, it says soft mesh material, and it has that, the padded chute on there with soft foam side. So if you guys want to retard the friendly for the systems, and you write your comments, already know that I'm probably going to have some discussions before that. Thanks for getting a lot of discussions. So
let's move on.
Yeah, look like we did the desk. So you could lengthen that out just to help the subsistence fishermen meet the requirements over time and not all of them done in 1 year because that same thing happen when we went to a smaller mesh size lunch thing.
We need to make a decision on this. If you would withdraw it or move forward with it in support of it, I have to agree with Mike that the only way that this is going to be talked about is at the Board of Fish. I think we spent a half hour or more on it, and I think we need to make that decision.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a motion if you like. I'd like to just add in the proposal and take out the 24 inch and say a size set by an emergency order by the manager. And add in the bag limit, so the size and bag limit will be set by the EO, and that we would, they would use the definition of measurement, however fits with what you're doing. In other words, nose to the fork and tail, whatever it is. So that's not just in there as a number. And then, let's, move it on with those changes. We can add some language over here, between now and the time we have to send it in.
Okay, on discussion of the motion, Mike and I have already agreed that we will work on some language to be added to the commentary. If anybody wants to join the conversation, more than welcome. The comments have to be submitted by December 30th.
Okay. Call a question.
Okay. You may get a second?
Yes.
Yeah. So we go ahead and vote on it?
Yep.
So,
you can find one more used to.
Okay. Gail Vick?
Yes.
Mark Richards?
No.
Mark Opie?
Yes.
Jeff Lucas?
Yes.
Gail Vick? Oops. Virgil Umpenhauer?
Yes.
Mike Tinker?
Yes.
John Wozinski?
Yes.
Levi?
Yes.
I'm a yes. Austin Smith?
Yes.
Warren?
Yes.
Larry's absent. Mike Kramer?
Yes.
Chuck Derrick?
Yes.
Gabriel Davis?
Yes.
I have
13.
Yeah.
Yes.
13-1-1 Aspen.
Is that what you came up with, Mark? Okay.
Okay, so Mike and I will do it on my heart.
Okay.
Okay, let's go through them. Number 82, which is steel net specs for the river, which ADFG, we do support that. Number 83, is lawful gear for personal use on the Yukon River. That was the department's proposal that we do support. Number 84, lawful gear on Yukon River. We tabled this for discussion tonight. I'm going to read my paper has been suggested. I think we support this. We suggested language, and I did not support my hearing all of this. The AC is in total support of rewriting these specifications. We have recommended some of these changes for years. The department gets their stamp of approval for getting it drafted. We realize there are technical changes required in the position published in the proposal book. We are confident staff can accomplish that for board consideration. Examples are a few misplaced side covers along the line as an acceptable gear type. So is that kind of what you were talking about, Mike?
Yeah, if I could just a little explanation, Mr. Chairman. There are a couple things in this when they were trying, they're trying to write an old regulation into new language that's much clearer and easier to be used. And when you do that, they're like they missed one gear type. There's a couple of places where the mesh size is, didn't get changed. You know, that kind of thing. So we don't want to just say, no, we don't want that, and I don't want to try to amend it specifically for that. they cleaned that up. They were at our meeting, and they know that that will need to be done. So I think we ought to move it on and let them go to that and get it in there, because the whole effort is a valuable effort for the management of fishery.
So one thing with this proposal 84, we did a lot of cleanup of the subsistence here. One thing we added new that we were considering putting in as a separate proposal, but we want to make sure everyone's aware of this, is for fall season, there's a thing where we want to drop down the mesh size from 7.5, which is currently low, that's our cleanup damage here, to 6 inches for fall season. And in fall season, people catch fall salmon solo. They rarely catch kings, and if it is, it's at the beginning of the season.
Yeah.
And 6 inches kind of a standard gear we use for commercials for fall salmon solo, and it's a typical gear people use for fishing. And so the idea is, the reason we put that in there is because we kind of like the king salmon, we want to set the zone at mesh size that harvests across the natural population and age classes instead of targeting the fewer, largest fish in our population. We saw the decline from the kings, and we're looking at those larger fish, and we're trying to help preserve our wholesome and our total fish. So other than that, most of the stuff in 84 will benefit the system fishermen. It's clean up, it's simplifying rigs. So that's the only change that your agency should probably also be aware of.
I think most of the people that you have 7.5 right now also have the 6 inch. Maybe that next thing 10 years.
Deanna, do you have a question?
Yeah, and I couldn't quite hear all that was said, but Gail, I think if you can get us a list of the changes and discrepancies that was noted in that reg, we can start drafting substitute language now. Yeah, the long line, hand line thing, that was a total oversight, kind of bonehead move on our part to note. You know, it's amazing how many people look at these things and those little errors can still slip through. So if you've got some changes, we can work on getting substitute language ready to go so that it can be looked at the board, and so that we'll have the best version going forward and have that ready to hand over to law once it gets to that point.
That's great, Tina. Mike, did you have some edits?
No, I think it's great. I think we just need to take it off the table. The committee needs to just bring it to the full advisory committee and authorize it going forward with those conditions. You know, right now, if you look at just the language and the changes they want to make, it's still a little deficient, but we'll fix that.
So can we get with you in a day or two, Dina?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, that was 84. Okay, 85. That is another department, one for the use on unlawful gear, and we are supporting that. 86 is a sportfish feeding bag limit, and we said take no action. This is the companion for proposal number 65, which we also took no action on. So this is for the animal drainage. 87, that is AYK to support that for type of legal gear. I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, Chrissy, that was the cleanup.
You said 87?
87.
87 is the finding of the yield stick.
Oh, the yield stick. Thank you. So I should put that in there. And so we do support that. 88 is, again, Yoma Sexton. What was the issue on 88?
Yeah, so for proposal 88, it's another refuel and replace of the commercial standard fishing gear. And what we're doing is we're getting rid of the penny time back to the regular, say, 8 inch, because this is currently the maximum is 7.5. And then we're trying to apply the conservation gear to all salmon. Right now, it's just in our commercial rig. If we want to go fish for summer chum, we can require that we release that change. But let's say our solo run came in really well and our fall chum run didn't,
we can't open a commercial fishery for coho and retire the release of some. So we're trying to make the conservation standards we have apply to all salmon species to give us more flexibility if we can provide opportunities and control in other species. And then I think that was the two things about the whole
question. Yep. Number 89 is summertime management on the Yukon. And we do support that as a department, and there's a great video about sending lines on in the internet.
It's about a video of a father beating up his daughter.
Oh, no, she was beating up on him. Yeah, she was quick. How she sprung out the gift net into the water, and boy, she was quick. I wanted
that. She was on it.
Yeah.
So the next proposal, we take no action, number except for number 891. We tabled it for discussion here, but honestly, I went back and looked at it again. It's a little too convoluted for us to tap on it. It's a complicated issue, so I'm going to suggest some DNA on that. All right, so that pretty much sums everything up. I would prefer that that one's gone.
I'm not sure if he's seen this.
Okay, so
because you don't have a piece of paper.
When we get to that, the time lord and look at the comments, I'll talk to Chuck and a few others putting up our comments. So we are going to support it.
In writing means I tried to capture what was talked about the other night, and we can tweak it.
Your fishery subcontrol, were they happy with the current rate, and then they just wanted that little fourfish portion change? I guess
it's how I ended up. Well, we wanted the trigger removed because the population doesn't really justify penalizing the summer sport fishery with its low harvest. That was a key in going ahead and keeping the rest. The other is, we don't have enough data to really mess with the 1500 number and that.
Okay. Yeah, I guess if you support 63, right now you can take two fish over 30, and then from that you can throw one fish over 30.
Yeah, oh yeah, you're right. That's true. Yeah, we were putting this comment in because it's the only place we can talk about changing. So we don't support the new limit.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's my note in the sideline here too. We don't support the new limit. To support the existing limit, but take off the trigger.
Yeah.
That's what we're trying to do here. Good catch. Thank you.
Don't support the annual basis establishment. Don't support the change.
Correct.
The daily basis is 30.
Yeah.
But you want to go next trigger for 750 to 1500.
Check. And we don't have any other place where we can really comment like that.
That's okay. I didn't want to say.
No, you're right. No, you're right. We're not supporting changing the. Okay. And we're not supporting changing the, you got to keep the first 10 fish you catch.
Yeah.
So we have to change our recommendation there, Deb.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll get the deal in the language. Yeah, that's fine. We're good there.
Thank you for that, Dash.
That's great.
I don't know if it's a support for that.
Opposed with consideration of the amendment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're changing that.
So the board would have to take up a new issue with that. Because I don't think there's any pipe proposals in here that look to me like they're going to get passed as they are.
So we're changing 63 from opposed with consideration for amendment?
Yes.
Okay. All right, everybody will mark that.
What would they do? The board generated a
chokehold. Yeah. Just amend the trigger.
All they do is take the proposal and someone makes a motion to amend it.
Yeah.
And they amend it.
They just amend it. In this case, they would substitute the language for the bag limit and size change. They would just amend that language out and adopt language that allows the 1,500 fish to be caught without influence on the summer fishery.
Yeah. And I mean, years ago, like in 2016, that board fish year, we actually had a proposal for this fishery here. It wanted to reduce the bag limit of 10 per day. It wanted to drop it down from that sport fish, which was like 5 per day. And it was 2/3 inches or something. And so that proposal during the board fish meeting, we received a similar comment and a different suggestion, and it actually got forced into language of just a 3-mile close area. And
right.
To do with
the exactly. Limit. We were in the middle of that.
Passed it. However, if the board may or may not take up your guidance amendment, they may say that this one needs to go out for public comment if anything but change, or they may say that's a good idea based on the possibility of principle.
Same with every other proposal. This advisory committee never expects all of our proposals to get adopted by the board. No, it didn't.
This is not our proposal. It's the
yeah.
We good?
Yeah, we're good.
All right, I want to make a motion that we approve all of the fisheries subcommittee recommendations, leaving out proposal 81 that we've decided separately.
Second. Okay, we'll take a vote unless I hear.
I just ask unanimous consent.
Unanimous consent. Yep, yep. Passes.
You're done.
100 hours. Be back at 2010.
Yeah.
That's not the season. You're going to kill yourself. You're driving. So we're saying you're.
Well, I mean, like, unless you have to go to, like, Nova or something, it still happens.
Yeah, no, it has to be there, right?
Oh, yeah.
No,
I'm going to go here. They spent $100 in Costco to get, like, oil. They spent $100 on meat. Smoke stuff.
Surround the big dinner?
Yeah. It's appetizing. I'm going to isolate.
What time? Can I come?
I don't know, you know.
Okay.
Probably earlier, because some people have kids, and when you come to bed, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
if there's food, Mark wants to be there early, isn't
it? Like, I mean, I see probably has 3 kids. Like, 4? I think 4 or 5. Like, they have 3 kids. Yeah. Zach has 3 kids.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I'm glad she caught that 63, Mike. I thought we were opposing it, but I was like, well.
Yeah.
But it says a
I don't. It was just so correct.
Sure. And I was like, well, maybe after the main YouTube talk and you changed it, but like, I was like, oh, well, I didn't meet with a smoker. I was at the meeting, but I wasn't fully, like, immersed, like, I am here. I mean, like, I was trying to pay attention back and forth, and I was like,
we were sitting.
I know, Will. I know. I mean, we were friends. They were friends. We were acquaintances.
Yeah.
So I texted him, like, hey, I think you know, we're not going to be a job. I was a job. And then in here, I'm like, maybe I was an animal pick all right. But I'm like, speak on it.
No, that's it.
Hey, dude.
Although they have a listen to it, because I'm middle.
I'm going to call the meeting to order.
That's not the secret.
Oh, we need gavel.
We'll
go drill sergeant. It's okay to be a drill sergeant. You're going to have to drill.
Okay, next on the agenda is the game prep subcommittee recommendations on Region 1. For game proposals, I'm going to turn it over to Mark.
Okay, we only had 5 of us there. Lance was there as an alternate at the game prep subcommittee meeting. So has everybody had a chance to go over our recommendations? So I really don't want to go through all 54 proposals.
No,
I agree.
So just a highlights. So we did want to weigh in on some of the trapping proposals. We have a lot of trappers on our committee, and of course we want to defend our trapping rights. So we did weigh in, even though they're outside our units, we did weigh in on several of the trapping proposals and supported those. We did oppose one of them. Just a couple of things. The first, we have some members that wanted to go on proposals 1 and 2 about Hunter Ed. We all like Hunter Ed. It's very important. There was a proposal, though, to require Hunter Ed well beyond the 1986 requirement for units 1 and 5. So there's so many rural residents there. We felt it disenfranchised too many hunters in the remote locations. They wouldn't be able to complete the in-person qualification. So while we do support Hunter Ed and we think it's very valuable, we don't want to have it required in areas where people aren't able to attend the meetings. Again, if anybody wants to go over some of these, I'm happy to hear that. We TNA'd most of the proposals because they're well outside our area of expertise. So I feel a little bit, you know, that everybody should be knowledgeable of what we supported and what we opposed, but I didn't want to go over every single proposal. So if anybody has any proposals they're interested in or have questions, now would be the time to raise them.
Mark, were there any that caused you guys significant discussion, or was it pretty much the same on all of them?
Yeah, we had some discussion on the Hunter Ed ones, the first one, because we do support Hunter education, and number two, Hunter orientation for goats. We went over that for a little bit. There's only one subunit in those units that is a billy only. So we didn't feel that, you know, the educational requirement for those units was really beneficial. But some of the, you know, there were some, there was a lot of them from the Alaska Wildlife Alliance about Unit 2 wolves that we just took no action on rather than oppose, even though, you know, we don't feel the board's, you know, going to go for those. So
we opposed the one about the killing wolves for 2 days because the current reg is 7 days. That's number 47.
47? Yeah. Yes, require reporting within 48 hours of recovery and stealing within 14 days. And
that's a tough compliance.
Yeah, most hunters are out there for more than 2 days, so to get a wolf and then have to immediately come in and report it, it just wasn't going to work for them. But again, in Southeast units, we don't know much about those units. We took no action on most of the proposals. As you can see from the sheet here, hopefully it has to be.
I think 47 is lengthening what it is right now. I read it into there. In fact, one of the areas was the Parkland's fabric right now has to report quicker in the district than the
I don't follow you there, Al. I thought it was a 7 day reporting is what we went over.
Yeah, 7 days the current.
Yeah.
They wanted 2 days.
Yeah.
They EO that thing. To make emergency orders on that report earlier.
The department did? Just recently or?
Yeah, that's won't be closed down.
Yeah.
So who made this proposal?
Wildlife.
Yeah. So even the way it is, if they're going to be EO and it, just let them EO. You don't change the background.
The thing that we talked about was, you know, goes to the same with the requirement for hunter's eggs. You know, a lot of people are remote and are only, you know, if they shoot a wolf the first day of their deer hunt, they're going to have to come in and get this thing filled and ruin their whole deer hunt, whereas it's already 7 days, so it's already a quick turnaround, so we didn't see a reason to support it and make it shorter.
Mr. Chairman, another comment on that is that if you let especially non-hunter types get these things tightened up, then that becomes a standard. Yeah. And they'll try to tighten all of them up, and that's, you know, that's not a good thing.
And this came up with the fisheries subcommittee too. I mean, some proposals, I mean, we've been around long enough, we know what the board is going to say.
Exactly.
So, and while it's important to oppose them, you know, all the wildlife clubs, we just, it's a waste of time, we know. So, and I know the Southeast region isn't important to a lot of here, but it would be good to have more people come to the game trap at City Bees if you can. That way, we're all more knowledgeable about what's going on, and at these full meetings, we don't have to wonder what the subcommittee is voting on. But
always suspicious of that committee, Mark.
I will make a motion that the full AC supports the recommendations of the Game Trap subcommittee.
Second.
For the reason one, of the game performance.
Okay, unless I hear otherwise, there's. Take that as a unanimous consent. Okay.
Yeah. I just have one comment relative to what Matt was just saying about people going to the subcommittee meetings. With Zoom now, it's really nice to go to the other agencies and you've had an opportunity to do that.
I agree. Yeah. The only trouble I tried to call in, I was under the weather and didn't want to go, and I couldn't get through. It didn't work for me, so
okay,
no. I don't know if that's where I live or what. Yeah. But
I think
you tried after we closed it out.
Yeah,
and I was texting Levi, and
Mark were there, York,
and they know what I was.
50 minutes it took the meeting, you know, so it was a very short meeting.
Yeah. It wouldn't have changed the outcome if I was there.
Jeff would have supported all the AWA.
Mark, I think did Kyle email us, like, the Delta?
I have Kyle email me those. I don't think he mails them to everybody.
You can just email them to everybody.
Yeah.
And then if you want to attend the Delta meeting or Panama meeting,
just listen in.
I think it would have hurt us at all of us.
Yeah.
You can always delete it if you don't want it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll
do
that.
Very easily found on the Fish Game website.
Yeah.
Yeah. On the AC.
Yeah.
I think they have a Facebook. Because we have a Facebook page.
I don't know if anybody's updating our Facebook page at all.
I am.
You
do? Yeah. My question will get things. No, so when we started that, we did not want to have people be able to
talk.
So, and I talked with, I just forgot his name there,
Mike Trappers,
and he spent 3 hours a day on it.
Ross.
And I said, Ross, I told Ross, I said, I don't have 3 hours every day to go through and check everything and do it. So, I do the meetings, the subcommittee meetings, and I just repost them. When Kyle sends it out, I repost it, and that's about all I do.
Good.
So there, I don't know if anybody follows it very closely, but somebody was able to hack into it and posted a picture of a naughty something on there, and I seen it, and it later got removed, so I don't know how many people actually seen that. And I'm not that good to know how they, you know, got in there and did it, but it's gone now, and so, but anyway, yeah, people do try that, and it takes up some time, but, you know, I'm okay with the amount I do, but I don't want to have people to be able to comment on there.
No, we don't want that.
Yeah.
And if anybody wants to help out or be an alternate, let me know. I can make it happen.
Okay.
So the next up is to set the next subcommittee meeting dates.
There are 2 days before this committee meeting, so I think January, I have in the calendar.
Is that enough time, Gail, 2 days before to get...
It is.
You're okay?
It seems to be an attention span, you know.
You're talking about right before AYK, Jim?
Yeah, and we're going to... We'll have that discussion in a minute about the AYK.
So you see, you're going to look at like 11, 12. It starts on the 14th.
Yeah.
So
11 or 12 feet.
Well, like, yeah, 11 is our number.
11
is yeah, that's what I was scheduled with it.
4 weeks up.
9. Okay, 9.
Oh, yeah, 10. So I'll be Jan 9.
Yeah.
Okay. January 9th.
Okay, January 9th.
Okay, we don't need to have a game trap subcommittee meeting next month.
Yeah.
The reason to do board game meetings in March, so we have plenty of time to go over those proposals in January.
The January subcommittee meeting is going to be very critical, not for BYC, but for Area M.
Yeah. So you might do something right at the end of February, Mark, so that we're set up.
Yeah.
In time to adjust things for the Southeast Region 2 meeting.
We could set that.
Oh, there is
February was set that.
We could.
Well, I think it was whatever you want to move on to the trees you want to play business.
Yeah,
to bring up.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to move on to community and fisheries, wildlife-related business. The first thing I want to do is bring up who will represent the AC in Anchorage on the 14th through the 18th at the Egan Civil Center for the Board of Fish. That's for AYK.
I thought originally I was going to be able to be at that meeting, and now I really want to be at the Area M. And I know it's Virgil and Mike Kramer as well.
Do we have the funding pile for to send people to both?
The representatives at both the Board of Fisheries meetings, especially if they're not open to having remote testimony, but I think they should get to the Board of Fisheries meetings. Those are allowing the remote testimony, both for public and AC members, which was
we can't send anybody to South Central Board of Game Meeting?
I think it might be possible, but normally we have the budget to send the meeting. So I guess that's what it is.
We have a huge number of constituents who participate in Region 2. And that's the argument we usually use, Kyle.
Okay, yeah. So I'd be happy to kind of follow up the implication of the executive director on board as far as the funding to ask for the board to
is the board game budget separate from the Board of Fish? For
no, not for fish. There's a budget for each country.
Yeah, right, that's what I thought. So if we split the difference, like if we can support Virgil going to the Area M, I think I can get funding from other places, and I have a place to stay already for Area M, but not go to the AYK. I don't think there's anything on the docket for AYK that is a burning issue. If we put our comments in for 81, it's going to have to speak for itself.
And get them in good and early.
Okay. Okay. We're not sending anybody to the Board of Fish. So we are. We're going to send somebody to the Area M.
Yeah.
And I, Virgil, and Mike Kramer said he could probably attend. He's still on. He can trust that.
Yeah, he's still on.
Okay. I think he could attend on his own, and I can do that probably.
Great.
He needs his support. Support that was free up from the week before game.
Yep. Okay. That'd be good.
So we're sending Virgil to the Area M.
Yep. Get him out of our hands for a couple of days.
Do we want to, is anybody willing to go to, I'll be there for RAC, but does anybody from the committee want to attend the South Central meeting in Sultana in March? Is anybody here?
I'm not getting any interest. If you need me to, I can. If you need me, I mean, I don't know. We weighed in enough to send somebody or not. Can you weigh in for us while you're there?
I can, but again, I mean, it works, but it would be probably preferable to have someone.
Back on?
I can deal with
it. Good question, then.
it might be please Bergen just put on the record that you would like to send people pending funding in case there's somebody on the outside that can find some private funding for someone to go later. That way you guys don't have to assemble and try to do it later. So I mean, if you can approve the people that you want pending funding, then you've already made the funding move.
Yeah. But we do, Kyle just told us, we do have funding to send somebody to the area and then to the Soldado meeting, correct?
Yes.
So there is no pending funding.
We wanted to send someone to the Southeast Region 14 meeting?
No. No.
We haven't got a date yet. Is even the park still there? For the board, for the hatchery, which is usually one day. And they said they tend to go schedule for March. We haven't had a date posted yet. Have you heard anything, Kyle, on that?
I don't know if there's an exception.
Hey, Gail, this is Dina with Fish and Game.
Yeah.
I'm on the board of...
Sorry?
You dropped out, Dina. You're still there. You're unmuted, but we don't hear anything.
She's on the website. I have it. She's going to say.
What are you going to say, Mark?
On these proposals for Region 2, maybe we should look through those to talk about in January and see, not worry about making a decision on sending somebody until we see what's in there.
You want to have a game trap subcommittee?
Well, I think we might want to after that, when we take it, but let's take a look at those proposals between now and then.
Okay.
Until January. And we can discuss it at the January meetings whether you need to have an official meeting.
Okay.
Sounds good. The meeting, the hatchery committee meeting is set for March 9th.
Well, they just posted it then. I think that's what Dina was trying to say. March 9th. Okay. So, yeah, that just happened then.
So, what's going to be on March 9th?
The hatchery
meeting.
Oh, hatchery. That's right. Yeah.
So, Jeff, you're willing to go and represent us at the Soldado?
Yeah.
This hatchery meeting, I'm sorry to interrupt here. This hatchery meeting on March 9th, is that just going to be a one day, you know, committee meeting? No comment, no, you know, issues.
There will be public comments, but there's going to be no, probably during the meeting. But it depends on how they schedule it.
Sometimes they will have public comments. They have before in the past.
Are you going to stay a little time?
Yeah.
Do you drive it?
You're probably fine.
I'll buy it.
Every time you go,
I might fire it out.
Right. Or me.
Yeah. I just, one more thing I wanted to bring up. I don't know how this happened, but the Western Arc Caribou Herd is meeting today and tomorrow.
Oh.
Now, we used to have a member represent us there. I know Dave Kilborn is there, but apparently he's representing the Fairbanks Hunters, and I don't know what group that is.
Mm-hmm.
But I have talked to Kyle about it, and didn't you go and represent us the year before?
I went three years ago.
So how is it that we don't have a member at that meeting? I don't. Go ahead, Al.
So Fairbanks doesn't have an AC spot.
Oh, I thought we did.
No.
Well, what did John go and represent us?
Well, I used to be on before John was.
Yeah.
Ron Arnold was on before that. But it's a Fairbanks hunter spot. So whenever they organize the Western Arctic Caribou Coalition working group, they never gave, like, Anchorage has, an AC spot.
Yeah.
Fairbanks is Fairbanks Hunters Fund.
Huh.
And so when I found that and things were going, I want to get involved with the Western Arctic Caribou Working Group, I went, hey, we don't have a Fairbanks AC guy. And whoever I talked with, maybe Ron Arnold before that, which wasn't even a Fairbanks guy, he just resigned and then I got the spot, you know, like from the ABC's mobile being there. And so then when I got off, you know, talking with Kurt, you know, to keep another guy on there. You know, we got John because Dave Kilborn. There was something
that he couldn't attend.
Yeah, it was that one year.
Yeah. John got in one or two meetings.
Yeah. One meeting, and then Dave took over the last two years. But with Kurt gone, I mean, I don't hear anything.
So maybe we should invite him.
Yeah, that's what I was going to bring up. So I would like to invite Dave for our next meeting to give a report on the veterinary care group.
So, you know, Kurt's idea was, instead of having, you know, somebody from the AC, which wasn't, you know, nobody really wanted to step up and do it. Dave is one of the persons that participates in that.
Yeah. And he's been hunting out that direction for a long time.
A good representation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because Kurt approached me and I agreed with it that, you know, I don't hunt up there, and it would be a lot better to have somebody that hunts fishes up there and has a cabin there. And,
yeah, I didn't have a Zoom this year, so.
So I will talk to Dave and we'll get him in
next month.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Maybe we can find
out. They never would let the Fairbanks. Why did they let the Anchorage AC and not the Fairbanks AC?
Whenever they organized, there's a couple AC slots on there, you know, but Fairbanks never had an AC spot. It was just called Fairbanks Hunters. And I don't know the history on that.
Huh? Okay. Well, as long as we got somebody we can talk to.
Yeah. Dave's good. So we're going to hear about that. Of course, the herd is hurting, and you know there's restrictions. So
I've been invited for the January.
Yes. The only other thing we've had.
Does anybody else have any comments or questions?
No, sir. Look good, Jen.
Second.
Yes. 20 buckets. 34. What do we have to do with this? I don't know. What are we doing?